He was born in a small Jamaican town, rose to become the most powerful black man on earth, and built a movement that stretched across five continents before being silenced by governments, betrayed by allies, and erased from history books. His name was Marcus Mosiah Garvey. He dreamed of ships, nations, and a unified Africa long before the world was ready. And though they tried to bury his voice, his fire only spread. This is not just a story about one man. It's a story of pride, exile, revolution, and the legacy that refuses to die. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Marcus Mosiah Garvey, A Journey Through Time, Episode 4. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 13, A Voice Silenced, A Movement Splintered, 1940-1950s, The Aftermath of Thunder, The Long Echo of Collapse. Death came quietly to Marcus Mosiah Garvey. No ceremony, no crowd, no procession of proud men in uniforms or mothers holding babies born into hope. No red, black, and green banners fluttering in the wind. No trumpets, no anthems, no fire-tipped speeches rising into the sky. Only stillness. A silent, rented room in London. A newspaper headline that mocked his name before his heart had even stopped beating. And a man who once made nations tremble with his voice, reduced, in the world's eyes, to a footnote. But history is a strange and stubborn thing. It doesn't always roar in the present. Sometimes it waits in silence, biding its time. And though Garvey's death went unnoticed by the powers that be, his absence rang louder than his fall. The day the wind died. In the hours and days after Garvey's passing on June 10, 1940, there was no grand international mourning, no government statements, no newsreels of dignitaries bowing in respect. The United Kingdom was too busy watching its skies for Nazi bombers. America was inching toward another world war, and the Caribbean was, as ever, suspended in colonial uncertainty. But within the broken, battered corridors of the UNIA, word traveled fast. He was gone. The sun around which the organization had orbited had disappeared, leaving only gravity and memory behind. Some chapters folded within weeks. Others carried on stubbornly, electing new presidents, holding monthly meetings, distributing what few copies of the Negro World still reached their communities. But without Garvey's voice, the fire flickered low. He had been the movement's heart, and now the heartbeat had ceased. A kingdom without a crown. The UNIA had once been a sprawling empire, a people's nation stitched together with vision and belief. But without Garvey, it fractured into fragments. Different factions claimed leadership. One camp based in Kingston insisted that Jamaica was the new capital of Garveyism. Another, rooted in Cleveland, argued for continuity in the United States. Some chapters pledged allegiance to George Weston, a longtime UNIA loyalist and organizer. Others turned inward, becoming more like social clubs than revolutionary vanguards. Infighting broke out. Resources dried up. Local leaders struggled to reconcile Garvey's original vision with the changing political landscape of the mid-20th century, a world now overtaken by new ideologies, global wars, and the emerging language of civil rights and decolonization. Garveyism, once urgent and alive, began to feel like scripture, revered but removed. The decline of the Negro world. One of the most immediate casualties of Garvey's death was the Negro World, the once mighty newspaper that had reached every continent, inspiring workers, students, intellectuals, and artists from Trinidad to Sierra Leone. Without Garvey's editorial fire, it stumbled. Its funding was slashed. Subscriptions dwindled. New voices failed to capture the magic of the original. The paper had been more than journalism. It had been a lifeline for a global black identity. Now it was pages and ink with no direction. By the early 1940s, it ceased publication entirely. And with its silence, the conversation Garvey had started about African redemption, economic sovereignty, racial pride, faded from regular discourse. The loudest microphone for the race had gone dark. The changing winds of revolution. While Garvey's flame dimmed, the world around him began to catch fire in new ways. World War II ushered in a violent reordering of the globe. Colonies sent troops to fight wars they didn't start, under flags that didn't represent them. When the war ended, many of those soldiers returned not just with medals, but with questions. Why had they fought for freedom abroad, only to remain shackled at home? In Africa, the seeds of anti-colonial revolution began to germinate. In Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah read Garvey's works as gospel. He absorbed the Unia's ideas of self-rule, national pride, and economic control. In Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta carried Garvey's words in his pocket. In the Caribbean, whispers of independence became movements. And in America, a young generation of black leaders, frustrated by segregation, police violence, and systemic poverty, began looking back through history for guidance. They found Garvey. But by then, he was a ghost, referenced more often than read, evoked more often than understood. The struggles of a left behind. The remaining UNIA members, loyal, graying, underfunded, tried to hold the line. In church basements, schoolhouses, and rented halls, they held annual conventions. They honored Garvey's birthday. They passed resolutions in his name. They sang the anthems he once composed. But the crowds were smaller. The media ignored them. The red, black, and green flags still flew, but now they flapped in corners, not across boulevards. The Black Star Line was a memory. The oratory, a recording. The president in exile never returned. It became harder to convince young people that once, just once, their people had declared nation, not on paper, but in soul. Garvey's family and final wishes. Back in Jamaica, Garvey's surviving family quietly endured the contradictions of legacy. Some treated them with reverence, descendants of a giant. Others whispered that Garvey had been delusional, his empire a vanity project, his downfall deserved. His body remained in England. He had died a Jamaican, lived as an American revolutionary, and been buried in foreign soil. He had no grand tomb, no state funeral, only the echo of a movement that had once held the world's attention in the palm of its hand. The myth takes shape. But time does strange things to memory. As the UNIA fractured, Garvey the man began to fade, and Garvey the myth began to rise. In Kingston, street poets began referencing him in verses. In Harlem, barbershops told stories of when Garvey rode through the streets like a king. In Nairobi and Accra, his name was included in pamphlets calling for African independence. In Ethiopia, Rastafarians began to speak of him as the prophet who had foretold the coming of Haile Selassie. Garvey, once mocked as theatrical, now became mythic. His speeches elevated to scripture. His photos hung in altars of black pride. His dreams revisited as blueprints. His silence had become sacred. The cost of the crown. But the myth came at a cost. With every passing year, Garvey's actual complexities were sanded down. His human flaws, his stubbornness, his miscalculations, his mistakes were erased or ignored. His successors either tried to imitate him or distance themselves from the scale of his ambition. But no one filled the space he had left behind. There would be future leaders, strong, brilliant, fierce. But none would attempt what Garvey had. To declare, in the face of a laughing world, that black people were a nation, deserving not only of equality, but of empire, and to try, against every odd, to build it. Chapter 14, The Man the World Forgot, 1940s, 1970s, Memory in Chains, Truth in the Shadows. Some men die once. Others die every time their name is erased from the stories they helped shape. When Marcus Mosiah Garvey died in 1940, his body went cold. But the world did not freeze with it. The clocks kept ticking, borders kept shifting, and the slow, brutal machinery of empire kept grinding forward. And so for decades, Marcus Garvey, once the most famous black man in the world, vanished from the official record. No statue, no holiday, no mention in schoolbooks, no inclusion in presidential speeches, no curriculum bearing his name. It was as though a cosmic hand had swept the pages of history clean, leaving behind only smudges and whispers. It wasn't an accident. It was intentional erasure. The world forgot Marcus Garvey, not because he failed, but because he dared to succeed too loudly. The politics of forgetting. In the decades following Garvey's death, the world underwent seismic shifts. The collapse of colonial empires, the rise of civil rights, the explosion of new African nations, the birth of the United Nations, the Cold War, and nuclear diplomacy. But in all this talk of liberty and democracy, Garvey's name was rarely, if ever, invoked. To the architects of a new world order, Garvey was an inconvenience, a ghost from a time they wanted to leave behind. He did not fit into the polished narrative of progress. He was too radical for liberals, too proud for integrationists, too grounded in African sovereignty for Western allies, too controversial to celebrate without footnotes. And so they pretended he had never roared. He became a footnote in dusty archives, a forgotten passport stamped by the hands of revolution. The silence in schools and streets. Across the Caribbean, generations of students went through primary and secondary education without ever hearing Garvey's name. In Jamaica, his birthplace, children recited English poems and studied European kings, but were never taught that one of the most powerful black leaders in modern history had walked their own soil. In America, civil rights heroes were mentioned, Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, even W.E.B. Du Bois. Yet Garvey was absent from textbooks, reduced to perhaps a single dismissive line, if that. In Africa, newly independent nations were eager to forge fresh identities. Some turned to Nkrumah or Lumumba, others to socialism or nationalism. Few officially acknowledged that the first man to dream of a modern Pan-African empire had done so decades earlier, under flags they now called their own. In the streets, old UNIA banners gathered dust in trunks. Parade songs written by Garvey were forgotten melodies. The red, black, and green flag still flew, but no one taught its origin. It became a symbol with no name. The war on radical memory. The silence was not passive, it was manufactured. The FBI, through its COINTELPRO program, deliberately suppressed radical black movements and voices. Even in death, Garvey remained on watch lists. His writings were categorized as subversive. UNIA members were surveilled. Associated political movements were painted with suspicion. Colleges were discouraged from studying his philosophy. Newspapers ignored the anniversaries of his birth and death. Mainstream historians dismissed him as an eccentric, a charlatan, a failed businessman. And for a time, they succeeded. The world forgot that Marcus Garvey once moved 6 million people, that he once launched a global shipping line with money raised from laborers and housemaids, that he stood before 25,000 people in Madison Square Garden and declared a new black empire, that he redefined what it meant to be African, no matter where on earth you stood. Forgotten. By design. The remnants that refuse to die. But memory is not always buried. Sometimes it sleeps. And while the world erased Garvey in ink, his flame lived on in voice, in barbershops and reggae lyrics, in whispered stories passed from grandmothers to grandchildren, in the books that survived in backrooms and basements, in the eyes of those who still raised the red, black, and green at protests, whether they knew his name or not. And in Rastafari, Garvey became more than memory. He became prophecy. Followers saw him as a forerunner, the John the Baptist of black redemption, who had foretold the rise of Ethiopia's Emperor Haile Selassie. To them, Garvey was not dead. He was risen in dreadlocks and drumbeats, in the sacred herbs and chants of resistance. Echoes in the diaspora. In Trinidad, Calypsonians invoked his name in resistance songs. In Ghana, young leaders quoted his writings without citation, not out of theft, but because his ideas had become truth beyond ownership. In Harlem, some elders still remembered the parades, the uniforms, the oratory, the moment the street transformed into a nation. Even in prison yards, his name was scratched into walls beside Malcolm and Mandela. He had become something more than a man. He had become a signal, a coded reference among the oppressed. Say Garvey, and people understood. Pride, power, reclamation, Jamaica's shame and redemption. Back in Jamaica, as the years rolled into the 1950s and 60s, there was growing discomfort among scholars and activists. How could the island claim independence in 1962 without acknowledging its greatest revolutionary? How could Garvey's name still be absent from school books, monuments, and currency? A movement grew, slowly, steadily. Calls for national recognition intensified. Young historians demanded the repatriation of Garvey's remains. Poets and playwrights resurrected his speeches. Reggae artists sang his name over thundering bass lines. And in time, the silence began to crack. A whisper before the storm. By the end of the 1960s, the world had changed. New revolutions had erupted. New leaders had risen. But through the chaos, something returned. The voice. Not through microphones, but through music, through street protests, through public memory clawing its way out of the graveyard of forgotten giants. People began to ask, not just who was Marcus Garvey, but why were we never taught his name? And when that question is asked, the world begins to shift. Chapter 15, The Rise of the Garveyite Flame, 1960s, 1990s, Resurrection Through Revolution, Sound, and Spirit. There are men who vanish when they die. And then there are men like Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Men who only begin when the body ends. For decades, his name had lingered in exile, buried beneath colonial guilt, hidden beneath whitewashed textbooks, smothered by the very governments he once dared to challenge. But no lie lasts forever. No silence can suppress a truth that has lived in the marrow of a people. What Garvey left behind was not merely an organization. He left behind a spark. And beginning in the mid-20th century, as the world heaved beneath the weight of racial tension, war, and revolution, the Garveyite flame rose again. Not from podiums, but from street corners, from speaker boxes, from stages, protests, pulpits, and songs. The Pan-African Reawakening. The 1960s were a furnace. As European colonial powers relinquished their grip on Africa, a new generation of African leaders emerged. Leaders who had grown up hearing Garvey's name whispered like scripture. They had read the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey in secret. They had debated the meaning of Africa for the Africans in dorm rooms, cafes, and refugee camps. Kwame Nkrumah, Ghana's first president, openly declared Garvey one of his primary influences. He had read Garvey's speeches in the libraries of London. When Ghana gained independence in 1957, the first sub-Saharan African nation to do so, Nkrumah named Black Star Square in his honor. The new national shipping line, called the Black Star Line, the flag of Ghana, a black star at its center, radiant over red, yellow, and green. From Senegal to Tanzania, from Nigeria to Zimbabwe, leaders and movements echoed Garvey's vision of a unified, self-governing Africa, free from European control, rooted in its ancient greatness, and committed to defining its own future. He had died in exile, but he was reborn as Africa's long-lost prophet, the American Reckoning. While Africa stood on the edge of independence, America was on the verge of rebellion. The civil rights movement surged through the 1950s and 60s, nonviolent marches, sit-ins, boycotts, and bus rides through hate-stained towns. Martin Luther King Jr. led with the voice of peace. But in the margins, beneath the hymns and handshakes, another voice stirred. A voice that remembered Garvey's thunder. That voice belonged to Malcolm X. Born Malcolm Little, his parents had been proud Garveyites. His father, Earl Little, had served as a UNIA organizer. His mother, Louise, was from Grenada, a woman who read the Negro World aloud to her children. Malcolm had grown up hearing the name Marcus Garvey not as history, but as doctrine. Though Malcolm forged his own path, his fire bore Garvey's DNA. His language of black self-sufficiency, Pan-African unity, cultural pride, and global solidarity all echoed from Garvey's playbook. He declared, "I'm not anti-American, I'm anti-oppression. I'm a Garveyite by blood." And when Malcolm X stood in front of packed churches, black college halls, and even the United Nations, demanding reparations and recognition, it was as though Garvey's ghost had returned to collect what the world still owed. The roots rise in rhythm. But perhaps Garvey's most unexpected resurrection came through sound. In the ghettos of Kingston, Jamaica, in the narrow lanes of Trenchtown and the zinc-roofed yards of Spanish Town. Young men crafted speakers taller than men and turned music into church. And at the center of their gospel stood Marcus Garvey. Reggae, born from ska and rocksteady, became a weapon of consciousness. Artists sang not only of struggle and love, but of revolution, repatriation, and pride. In Garvey, they found the father of their identity. Burning Spear released the album Marcus Garvey in 1975, his gravel voice chants roaring across tracks like sermons. Marcus Garvey words come to pass. Do you remember the days of slavery? Africa, the land of our fathers, we must return. Bob Marley, though more spiritual in tone, infused his lyrics with Garveyite ideas. Exodus, Africa as home, Babylon as oppression, Zion as destiny. He named Garvey alongside Haile Selassie, Paul Bogle, and Malcolm X in his songs. The Rasta movement, rising from a blend of Afrocentric faith, anti-colonial defiance, and biblical prophecy, made Garvey its John the Baptist, the forerunner who had announced black liberation decades before it arrived. Dreadlocked prophets stood on street corners quoting Garvey with the same reverence others quoted scripture. He had become holy, Jamaica's redemption. It took time, too much time. But eventually, the silence in Garvey's homeland began to fracture under pressure. Activists, scholars, musicians, and school teachers pushed harder each year. Where is Garvey in the syllabus? Why is he not honored among our heroes? How can we be an independent nation while ignoring our liberator? By the 1960s, Jamaica could no longer pretend. In 1964, Prime Minister Alexander Bustamante approved the repatriation of Garvey's remains from London. That August, his body was finally returned to the island of his birth, carried not in shame, but in honor. He was buried in National Heroes Park, Kingston, beneath a monument bearing his words, "Look for me in the whirlwind." In 1969, Marcus Garvey was officially declared Jamaica's first national hero. The man once shunned as a nuisance, ridiculed as a failure, imprisoned by foreign powers, was now immortalized as the spiritual father of a nation. Global recognition emerges. As the decades turned, Garvey's flame rose even higher. In the United States, civil rights groups, Pan-Africanist organizations, and black nationalists began calling for posthumous exoneration. They demanded that the federal government clear his name from the mail fraud conviction that had derailed his life's work. Congressional resolutions were introduced. Some passed, others stalled. But the noise grew louder. Barack Obama, during his presidency, was petitioned repeatedly to pardon Garvey. Though the request was never granted, the act of demanding justice for a dead revolutionary became itself a form of resurrection. In Africa, Pan-African summits began naming Garvey among the movement's earliest philosophers. In Brazil, Trinidad, Canada, and Liberia, Garvey's ideas became foundational to local black pride movements. Statues rose. Universities held conferences in his name. Children began learning what their grandparents had been denied: the eternal flame. By the dawn of the 21st century, Marcus Garvey was no longer a ghost. He was ancestor, icon, blueprint. His philosophies lived in activist circles, educational curricula, hip-hop lyrics, liberation theology, and national development policy. His legacy was not uniform. It had been bent, molded, misunderstood, reshaped. But it had survived. Because while ships can sink, while newspapers can be burned, while names can be struck from textbooks, truth finds a way. And Marcus Garvey's truth, his belief that black people, wherever they are one people, with one destiny, was more than a movement. It was a flame passed from generation to generation. And by the end of the 20th century, that flame was burning everywhere. Chapter 16, The Immortal Legacy of Marcus Garvey. Across time, from one man to a people's eternity, there are lives that end in silence. And then there are lives that never end at all, because they are no longer just lived by one body, but by millions. Marcus Mosiah Garvey was born in obscurity and buried in exile. But today, he is no longer just a man. He is movement. He is metaphor. He is the undying spirit of a people who refused to be erased. This final chapter is not an ending. It is a continuum, an echo that refuses to fade, a voice that whispers through generations. We were, we are, we always will be. A legacy written in red, black, and green. You see it in the flags of nations once held in chains. Red for struggle, black for the people, green for the land. You see it in the seal of Ghana, where a lone black star rises from the center, shining over a continent that once cried for unity. You hear it in the chants at protests on streets from Baltimore to Brixton, Accra to Johannesburg. Africa for the Africans. Power to the people. You feel it in the heartbeat of movements born long after Garvey's death, the Black Power movement, Afrocentric education, Pan-Africanist conferences, and diasporic cultural renaissances. Garvey's dream was never buried. It simply changed form. He had planted a seed so deep in the collective black psyche that it germinated through generations, through poetry and policy, through resistance and reawakening. And now, wherever black people stand and say, "We are not inferior. We are sovereign." That is Garvey, the blueprint of dignity. Marcus Garvey's genius lay not just in his oratory or ambition, but in the architecture of self-respect that he laid brick by brick. He was the first to say, not beg, not plead, but say that black people were not simply victims of history. They were its authors. He taught them that their hair was not a curse, but a crown. That their skin was not shame, but sun-etched legacy. That they did not need to assimilate to be accepted, but to rise as themselves, fully and gloriously African. Before multiculturalism, before black is beautiful, before African-American studies departments, before social media activism, before world leaders spoke of equity, Garvey had already built the vocabulary of emancipation. He gave his people permission to see themselves as whole. The first global black leader. In scope, Garvey was centuries ahead of his time. He was not local. He was not provincial. He thought like a general, preached like a prophet, and organized like a head of state. At a time when the world's most powerful nations were empires and colonies, when the word black was synonymous with poverty, shame, and subjugation, Garvey dared to globalize black identity. He was the first to build a mass political and economic organization that connected black people across five continents. He spoke not just to one country, but to a scattered people, telling them, "You may be divided by water, but you are one blood." He gave them ships, flags, schools, banks, and a vision of themselves as a nation without borders. And though the ships failed, the nation did not, because it was never bound to soil. It was bound to spirit. Lessons from the rise and the fall. To honor Garvey is not to worship perfection. He made mistakes, sometimes grand ones. He moved too fast, trusted the wrong men, elevated symbolism over sustainability. He clashed with allies, mismanaged funds, and fell into the hands of a government that feared him far more than it understood him. But his fall is as important as his rise. Because in his failure, we learn the price of pioneering. We learn that to try to move mountains is to risk being crushed by them. But we also learn this. It is better to build and break than to never build at all. Garvey's courage wasn't in his success. It was in his refusal to let reality shape his dreams. Instead, he tried to shape reality around his dream. And that is legacy, spirituality, and the eternal return. In the faith of Rastafari, Garvey was never just a man. He was the voice crying in the wilderness, the one who prepared the way for redemption, who foresaw the fall of Babylon and the rise of Zion. To millions of Rastas, Garvey's name is sacred. His words recited alongside scripture, his image found in places of worship, his vision deeply woven into the very essence of black spiritual resilience. Even beyond religion, Garvey's life has become mythic, not in the sense of fiction, but in the sense of moral architecture. He lives on in the collective imagination of a people who needed someone to tell them that their pain was not permanent, that their displacement was not divine punishment, but political theft, and that they could reclaim the throne. He lives in the whirlwind, just as he said, recognition, redemption, and the fight for pardon. In the modern era, the call to exonerate Marcus Garvey has become a cause for justice. Legal scholars, activists, and descendants have appealed to U.S. presidents, from Reagan to Obama, to issue a posthumous pardon for Garvey's 1923 mail fraud conviction. While no pardon has yet been granted, the movement continues to gain strength, fueled by moral urgency and historical clarity. A man who built the world's largest black movement should not remain a convict in the archives of a system that feared his power more than his paper trail. And even if a pardon never comes, history has already rendered its verdict. Marcus Garvey was never guilty of fraud. His only crime was awakening a people the world tried to keep asleep. The flame carried forward. Today, Garvey's legacy is alive in forms he could never have imagined. In black-owned banks and bookstores. In Afrocentric fashion that celebrates the same pride he preached. In Pan-African conferences that draw delegates from across the globe. In music from dancehall to hip-hop that chants his name. In diaspora youth who trace their roots with digital DNA, reconnecting the fractures he once tried to bridge. In hashtags and freedom marches, in liberation schools and decolonization panels, in the rebirth of African identities that refuse to be defined by foreign lenses. The Garveyite flame still burns. It burns in Lagos, in Atlanta, in Port of Spain, in Soweto, in Kingston, in Brixton, in every heart that still believes in sovereignty, dignity, unity, and ancestral return. And so the story never ends. This audiobook began in a small coastal town in St. Anne's Bay, Jamaica, with a boy no one believed would change the world. It ends here, with a world still reverberating with his footsteps. Marcus Mosiah Garvey did not live to see his ships reach Africa, but his soul got there first. He did not live to see his name cleared, but history cleared it anyway. He did not live to see his empire realized, but the dream never died. Because a people who have found their fire do not need a throne to rule. They carry it inside them. They are the throne. And as long as one voice still says, "Up, you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will," then Garvey lives.